I want to take some questions from the floor. The first question I have in mind, there's a lot of questions I got basically from Winston, and they're all for the Chief Constable, and they're all picking bones with him about how unfairly loyalists have been treated. And he anticipated that in a way and in his speech, but he's going to obviously hear more of that.
Don't be shooting the messenger.
The first question anyway that I have is from Harry Stockman. Harry, are you there? Yeah, even the shout loud and...
My question is to one panel, but particularly the Chief Constable. During the recent fail in Fogo event, the Chief Constable said, "Stronger House structures with the potential to make progress will emphasise the need for wider society to play a role." Are you, the panel, concerned that loyalism is not at the table and involved in these very important discussions?
Okay, are we, the panel, concerned that loyalism is not at the table for the political discussions? Are you, George? Does it mean the question is primarily...
Well, I need to do the policing bit. The principles set out in the Stormont House Agreement seem to me to be sensible. They did on Christmas Eve, the day before Christmas Eve last year, almost 12 months away now. It did seem to achieve political consensus for those that were in the room. But, you know, for that to get operationalised, to turn into reality, then people... who have been involved in all the challenges and difficulties and actions of the past need to at least be consulted. Now, I would have thought that is just good government and good legislation. I'm surprised to hear the lack of consultation with EPIC, for example, and other groups. But there is a wee bit in this, you know, I would present a challenge to you. We all know it took now 10 months to read the Stormont House Agreement. And albeit it took a leak, but the draft legislation, one draft of it was leaked in recent weeks. There is something about, you know, not waiting to be asked. You know, we all have a voice and can step forward, and I would encourage all participants, including the policing community, as well as loyalism and republicanism, to stand forward and make their voices heard. And I just think that sometimes people from loyalist communities are a bit slow in articulating a united, straightforward position that is cohesive, coherent, and compelling. And I don't mean to cause offence by that, but it's an observation. You know, we seem to have other facets of society that are very good and clear in articulating a reasonably united position. But I sometimes, never mind as a police officer, as an interested observer and somebody that watches the news and reads the newspapers, it's not always clear to me exactly what loyalists' perspective on some of these big issues are. It's been, you know, good for me to be here this morning, you know, even to hear the EPIC position, for example. There's things in there that, you know, I think are very valid points around consultation, involvement, and buy-in to the outworkings of the Stormont House Agreement. But actually, I'm just a cop. That's for the politicians to work out and to worry about. But I say it because I've got a stake in this. I want it to work, and there's no point in us ending up with a political framework or a legislative framework that actually does not meet the needs or that people feel that they have been excluded from or haven't had a voice in. But sometimes having a voice is about standing up, opening your mouth and letting words come out. I would encourage you to do that in the process.
So that's a fair criticism of EPIC. You're not making your case as clearly as you should.
Well, I would contradict that by the fact that we went to pains to have a few workshops last year and produced the document which is with you today. So I think EPIC, for a small organisation, has made an effort to do that. I made a reference in my opening remarks to the fact that I found it astonishing that the unionist parties in particular made no effort to consult with loyalist activists before they devised this architecture in order to deal with the legacy of the conflict. Bear in mind, these unionist parties are our representatives both in the Assembly and at Westminster. The PUP have not reached that stage yet where they have representatives who would be party to those discussions.
Okay, and you've made the argument essentially, Jude, but you'll perhaps want to make it again.
The way I do believe loyalism, for want of a better word, hides slain under a bushel and has difficulty representing itself. If I can just illustrate the point briefly, I had a chum come up there from Dublin and he said, I want to go to Van Morrison's house, the greatest singer in the world. I want to go to Jordy Best's house, the greatest footballer in the world. And I want you to take me to Alex Higgins' house, the greatest snooker player in the world. All three Belfast prods. It took me about 3 weeks to find these places. I mean, I'm running around Craigie trying to find Cooning Way. Have you ever tried to get to Van Morrison's house? Have you ever tried to find where Higgins hung out? And it was this notion that outside of the boundaries here, whatever we are, Northern prods are seen in a far more positive light, I feel, outside than they are inside here. I mean, if Jordy Best was a Catholic, we'd have an interpretive centre in Andy Town that puts a 30 quid in and 15 quid in. You know, if we ever had a singer like Van Morrison, but probably bloody kidnapped him, never let him leave the place, you know. You got to have, in my view, I suppose it was Irvine, you know, I still believe, without apology, the greatest man I ever met in my life outside my personal life. My son's here, so he's probably the greatest man too. But Irvine often said, you know, we do have terrible difficulty shining our light. I can assure you, we need to find out where Best and Morrison, you've got to have more confidence in yourself, basically. That's essentially what I'm saying.
Thank you very much. I'm going to jump over some of the questions on the list because we have covered the ground, but we can come back to them if we have time. But Tina Patrick, please, is Tina here? Tina Patrick here? Yes, Tina.
The Chief Constable on record, as is his predecessor, of emphasising the importance of policing the present rather than the past. However, Stormont House Agreement has an emphasis on the past, with the HET being replaced by the HIU. This could be considered as further falsing, raising the hopes of victims in spite of the claims by legal experts and others that the HIU will not lead to significant convictions. Would the Chief Constable then support a process of truth recovery with immunity, such as the one applied to the search for the disappeared, as the most realistic opportunity of addressing victims' requirements?
Thank you very much for that. Kieran McAvoy was very good in that when he said very emphatically that those who raise the expectations of victims that there will be many prosecutions are being irresponsible. So is the alternative something like immunity of the kind that was successful, very successful, in recovering the disappeared?
Well, I don't know. I have been very clear and careful to not raise people's expectations of a criminal justice outcome. I said that in my opening remarks. As time goes by, well, I think Ord put it much more powerfully than I have done this morning, but you know, basically as time goes by and memories fade and people die and exhibits get lost and forensic labs get blown up and all the rest of it, it becomes not quite impossible, but moving towards that end of the spectrum to bring a successful criminal justice outcome. So I, on dealing with expectations, I'm absolutely in the same place as Kieran and Sir Hugh and other people who have said similar things. What the model is for dealing with the past, I don't know. Asking me to support one model, I don't think is, you know, I have no greater insight or view in that than anybody else in this room, because actually that's what, you know, the various stages of dealing with the past, those four initiatives, most recently with Hass O'Sullivan and then the Stormont House Agreement, have been an attempt to do. And that sort of a solution, that framework or infrastructure for dealing with the past and how much of it goes down a criminal justice route and a information recovery route and a storytelling route and so on, are actually political judgments. And that's why we put the politicians in place to for them to give the leadership around all of that. I'm not averse to the discussion on any of these options. I did say once, a year ago. I simply tip my hat to the Attorney General's John Larkin's the debate that he triggered about basically drawing a line onto the past. I wasn't advocating it. What I was saying was that, you know, I didn't even really hear meaningful public debate about that option. Now, let me be clear, I'm not saying that that is the solution. I don't think it's the place for the Chief Constable to be advocating one solution over another. But I do think that the debate needs to be had. The key people most affected by the past need to have a loud voice in that. Victims and actors and so on. But, you know, the question, it's a good question, but actually I think it's one for the political leaders rather than the police leader to address.
But is there a cost to the prestige of policing when so many people are arrested and held and questioned and then released? I mean, you extended the run for Gerry Adams, for instance, up to 4 days in and nothing. Numerous cases we hear all the time of people being arrested and questioned and then released. Is that an embarrassment to you?
No, I think we've a story to tell, and I did put a challenge out to this party and to loyalism more generally about telling their story, and I think we have a lesson still to learn on that front as well, because you know, Mr. Adams was arrested, held for 4 days. He actually got to a point, because of the extensions, that had to go before a court, and we had to convince a judge that there was still necessary to detain this person, that there was reasonable grounds to do so, and that it was being conducted as expeditiously as possible, and that there was more need for investigative measures within that timescale. So this wasn't just people are not arrested for nothing, regardless of what they may say. The part of the police narrative that we haven't been good at getting out is the threshold for arrest is something called reasonable grounds to suspect. That does not mean someone is guilty. It does mean, however, that we have either got intelligence or evidence that poses questions for them. And part of the reason for arrest is to obtain evidence by questioning. It's a very different thing to say that the threshold for charging is actually a much higher one, where there's a reasonable prospect of prosecution. And in the Adams case, we decided not to go for the charging option, but a report was submitted to the PPS, and the PPS decided on balance and gave a very comprehensive reason behind it why Mr. Adams and others would not be prosecuted at this stage for the murder of Jean McConville.
But just to stay with this for a moment, the more we go into historic investigations where the evidence is getting weaker and weaker, the more frequently we're going to see the police in the embarrassing position of failing to nail the guys they want to nail.
Well, I don't see it as embarrassing. I mean, what we're not going to do is make the evidence up. Well, it wouldn't be a good idea for the police to do that. So we go where the evidence takes us. If the evidence takes us to that threshold of reasonable grounds to suspect, we will act on it, and if an arrest is appropriate, we'll make the arrest. If during the arrest and interview process further evidence is obtained that allows us to charge, we'll charge. We do that with integrity rather than embarrassment. We are saying, and we're trying to deal with expectations, that the longer time goes on and the more witnesses die and the more exhibits get lost, it's actually, and of course people will build a conspiracy around losing exhibits, but there's actually millions of them across the period of the Troubles. So of course there's going to be challenges around all of that, but I don't say that with any embarrassment. I think if there's any awkwardness around it, it might be that we haven't told the story and given a clear enough narrative around it. But we will go with confidence where the evidence and intelligence takes us. If that ultimately leads to a charge and a prosecution, great. But as I and other people have been very clear, we're not raising expectations. We're going to do our job, do it with confidence, do it with integrity, but actually we're not going to pretend that there's more in the evidential bucket than what there is.
Okay, thank you. Jude, how does this idea of an amnesty go down in the victim sector?
Not very well, as I'm sure you can imagine. I just forgot your name.
Tina.
Tina. Probably illustrates the enormous and complex nature of all this, and ultimately, in my view, the futile nature of it. The HIU, like the HET, will fail to deliver, because it's been asked to deliver something that is undeliverable, and that is that many, many victims want their day in court. And I think Kieran said earlier on that, I'm not quite sure what adjective you used, but it's certainly unfair and disingenuous to tell people that you will have your day in court. Many of these events took place 30 or 40 years ago. Many of the actors are dead, and I do not hold any hope that people will have their day in court. And I mean, this causes a lot of stress on the, you know, with victims. And but I mean, I have to be very careful what I say here. I don't want a day in court. I don't want to drag some man or woman from their home, probably in a loyalist working class area, to a court to get some bizarre satisfaction about them going to jail for 2 years. I mean, I'm on the record and I'm sitting beside the chief constable here, so I've got to be really careful what I say, because you know, I could find myself going up the road with a pair of handcuffs very soon. I would not give any information. If I knew you killed my mother right now, I would not pass that information on to anybody, because I see no value in doing it. And that's only my perspective. And I always have to be mindful of victims and the diversity of opinion. But I base my comments on pragmatism and context. Pragmatically, the HET did not deliver for 10 years and £11 million. And what it did deliver was, I think, were three convictions. My own family's interaction with them was less than satisfactory, and I do believe in many respects they ended up, not deliberately, but by hurting many victims far more than, you know, than bringing any comfort. And the second reason I wouldn't have that information is that I do not believe, if we treat this as a criminal conspiracy that started in 1996 and ended in 1998, we are deceiving ourselves completely. I see ex-prisoners as a central part of the peace process. Indeed, I do not believe that there would have been a peace process without ex-prisoners. I would just love to get to a society where ex-prisoners were redefined. Are you an ex-prisoner for the rest of your life? Does the reality of when you leave here, where meaningful employment is nearly impossible, where every time I'm a lecturer in the Belfast Metropolitan College, and I have to do risk analysis on 19-year-old young women who stole a Mars bar from Sainsbury's in 1972, and it's all exceptionally embarrassing. I want barriers down. I want to create conditions where you and I have a commonality, and this deceit, I'm actually very reluctant to use the word deceit, because deceit implies that there is a premeditated reason to deceive people. I base it on fact. Victims will not get their day in court, and I don't want my day in court. I understand the context.
Thank you very much. Tom, as somebody who's working with ex-prisoners and within the loyalist community, what do they think about the idea of an amnesty? I mean, an amnesty for loyalists would also mean an amnesty for Republicans and others. So are they game for that? Is that something they do want?
I think amnesty's a bit of a red herring, to be honest, because if amnesty didn't come with being anonymous as well, people... who are living lives that were probably involved in the conflict in the 70s, why would they make themselves public at this stage? But when they've moved on, the troubles are over, they've got families, they've got grandchildren, why would they expose themselves to what would label to come their way? If you take the example of ex-prisoners, those who have, as they say, served their time, paid their debt to society, as the term people would use, they are still facing problems. So you can imagine if somebody was to receive an amnesty, how much more disapproval would be heaped upon them if they were able to just say what they did in 1970 or whatever and walk away scot-free. So that's why I said, as part of the raft of measures to deal with the legacy, the issues that face ex-prisoners need seriously to be considered.
Thank you very much. Anybody in the audience like to chip in at this point? I mean, because I'm just... yes, guy in the white shirt.
Just wrote a few wee notes down there.
Oh, no. I don't want to hear a few wee notes. I want to hear a quick comment, because we're going to get around as many people as we can.
George, I know you gave a brief indication of some figures regarding the HET. Before your time, the AGT themselves showed that 65% of the people murdered during the conflict were carried out by Republicans, but yet then 89% of the people put through the system were unionists, stroke loyalists. How can you convince me, as a unionist, stroke loyalist, that this new system could give people like myself confidence?
Well, his figures are clashing with your figures, because the figures you gave were that 104.
Yeah. No, my figures have got to do with the referrals for investigation in relation to murders for the duration of the HET. So I can't just duck this on the basis that I only started this job 15 months ago. So what I'm saying is that first of all, my first position is we will go where the evidence takes us. But actually, if we are going to talk about figures, then we'll have to get them right. So 69 of the referrals for full investigation from HET into serious crime branch related to Republican paramilitary groups. Exactly half, or almost half, 35 of those referrals were to do with loyalist groups. That's on the record, official figures that we will stand over. Now, some of those might relate to multiple cases and all the rest of it. It's not our... We're not going to put parameters around the number of suspects or the number of arrests that are going to fall out of an investigation. We will go with whatever that investigative package reveals. So if the review shows that there's the investigation into this murder... And that there is the possibility of arresting one person. It could be the arrest of one person, or it could be the arrest of 12 people. So that's why, in some ways, the figures, whilst we may disagree on them, I can stand over my figures around the number of referrals from review to investigation being twice as many in the Republican community as it is within loyalism. But actually, we just have to go where the evidence takes us. And
there's also,
I think you'd be disappointed in your police service if we were starting to make arrests based on quotas and. That's just the way it works.
But there's also anxiety within the loyalist community about an alleged supergrass waiting in the wings, and waiting in the wings for a couple of years now for a big, big case that never seems to come round. What can you say? But I mean, apart from people are questioning the integrity of the system, but could you also give us any indication of when that's all going to materialise?
Well, the case that you're referring to has been ongoing too long. It's hugely complex. But again, the complexity in that is the sheer volume of material that this person is bringing forward and the implications for it. Now, you know, it's not a comfortable place to be in, but we can't get to a point where saying, like, we can only actually do... Will you stop implicating people? Because the more you implicate, the more difficult this takes and the more long it's going to be. We have to go where the truth takes us. And if people come forward and want to present themselves as a witness of truth, a couple of things need to happen. We and the prosecutor need to make a judgment of whether the person is a witness of truth. Ultimately, the prosecutor, and it is the prosecutor, the DPP, who enters into an agreement with the person that they are a witness of truth and that they will give evidence of what the process will be. That's beyond policing. All policing do is record an interview and take the download from the person they want to give. It's not my fault. It's not the problem of policing. If former members of loyalist paramilitary groups want to come to us and tell us their story, we're not going to send them away. We're not going to put parameters on them. We're not going to restrict them and say only 20 at a time, please. We'll take whatever. We have to collect evidence. It's a statutory obligation to do that. Now, once we've collected that evidence, there are questions about the weight of it, the credibility of it, the value of it.
Because the record of Supergrass trials is very, very poor, isn't it? I mean,
well, you know, Supergrass is not the term that I'm using.
No,
we're doing this under legislation that is much more recent than the Supergrass trials of the 80s, which were clearly unsuccessful. I'm not saying this will be successful. What I'm saying is the police have fulfilled our function in that, which is somebody from your community comes forward and wants to tell their story. We record their story, basically, and we present that to the Director of Public Prosecutions, who needs to make a judgment about whether this person can be relied upon as a witness of truth. Now, that is running its course. Part of it is because of the sheer magnitude of the material that we're dealing with. There are complications around, you know, stories been told about police officers and their behaviour, so that's all having to go to the Ombudsman, and then some of it's having to come to us. All of that's needing worked out. It sounds like I'm explaining, so I'm losing. But it's actually a hugely complex scenario. And I would hope at some point in the near future, we will get from the PPS a decision about what way that is all going.
And that's likely to be a very, very big trial with a lot of people in the dock.
Well, let's wait and see what happens. I'm not going to second guess the director. What I'm trying to explain to this community, to this party, is that in legislation, the police have a job to do, and we do that job with integrity and without fear or favour. Are we happy that this has taken 5 years? Absolutely not. But actually, you know, the person came forward to us, and that's we have to take the evidence off them and then allow it to be assessed and decisions made.
So if there's any old gunmen sitting out there today who want to unload themselves and burden themselves, you'll be happy to...
Leave my card with you.
Any other questions from the floor? Yes, the woman here. Yes.
And your address, tell the conference room, your address, sorry, you use Nanny Keyburn's Oak Graciousness and a few others, but one word important to me you left out was trust. You made comments about the Loyalist community, the news community, being slow and interacting and wanting to move forward. I don't feel that's the case at all. I see a lot of good work out the ground there, of people putting their left in the lane. And one corner doing their best to help at the request of other people from the community and finding themselves dragged through the courts in another corner.
Yes, carry on.
And what confounded that with me, the trust and the lack of trust within my community, it's not to want the people working and working hard to move forward, it's there. And it's quite evident to those who's willing to recognise it and see it. But you yourself confirmed my mistrust by just watching in the recent murders that have happened for the last lot of weeks there over where I live. And you come out and you didn't hesitate in saying that knew that the IRA were involved, whatever that had to be, they were involved in the murders of Jack Davidson and Kevin McGuigan. But for me, what confounded that for me as a member of the community in regards to trust was that even though it was a live investigations and the Jews were working and everything you had, during your investigation or any past prosecution, you were going to have to be mindful of the political consequence if you do that. Now that is on record, you saying that. So that just not me, and I'm sure it has not many members of my community backwards.
Well, first of all, I agree with you that building trust is also a key element if we're trying to build. You know, I did say things like we needed to work together.
Is it difficult to trust former UVF men? If you're dealing with former UVF men, former paramilitaries, people who've killed, people who've robbed, and you're meeting them through your line of business, do you not retain some suspicion of them?
Well, you know, that's human nature.
The IRA, yeah, of course, yeah.
Am I going to get the answer to this here? Or is this going to get machine gun question? Well, first of all, I think trust is critically important. Trust is where we need to get to. Do I trust everybody that I meet 100%? No, I don't. Trust needs to be built, and trust in me needs to be built, and in the police service. I accept that, and we have a piece of work to do, and I think trust is a two-way thing. But actually, how do you build trust? You build trust by taking a few risks in relationships, and you build trust by showing that you're as good as your word. Now, the problem with... You have made this suggestion that I have said I need to be mindful of the political consequences. I'm sorry.
That's
if,
not a suggestion. That's effective. See, not the print.
Well. No, I need to get my lines better grafted, because what I actually said was that we will pursue the investigation with integrity, without fear or favour. I have said, and this is the exact words that I used, I will not be fettered by political commentary or political consequence. That's what I said. That's what I've had discussions with all the political parties about. And actually, I am going to be... Yes, I mean, you can't pretend. You know, it would be foolish to arrest some very high-profile political figures and not work out, now, what impact is this going to have in the community? But that doesn't mean that you don't make the arrest. I think our actions over the 17 arrests in the McGuigan murder, for example, have proven that we'll go where the evidence takes us, unfettered by political consequence or commentary. So, I'm sorry, I disagree with you. You're wrong. I'm not going to be dictated to by politics. and I'm not going to be restricted.
But you just endorsed it, because you said your evidence would take you where the consequence would be. So you must have had something on them to go there in the first place, or were you just wasting your time?
Sorry, I don't understand the challenge.
No, I think we can take. I think we take that as read. Anybody else wants to? There's a Gillian. I've been trying to get in then. Somebody else, if there's anybody who wants to give me a steer on when you want this wrapped up, by all means do. But
that's great, Gillian. Thank you, Malachy. After the murder of Tom Davison, David Ford, the Minister of Justice, publicly stated that irrespective of his past, individuals like Mr. Davison should be supported if they're making a positive contribution to their communities. Would Chief Constable agree that such public support is rarely attributed to loyalism? We need to look no further than the recent public onslaught of my party leader, Councillor Billy Hutchinson, because of his appointment to the board of the Northern Regional College. Given this, would the Chief Constable now publicly endorse the work of Billy Hutchinson and others like him with a similar past?
Do you think Billy Hutchinson will be a good school governor? I think that's the question.
Well, I think... Well, let me answer that question. When you're doing assessments of people's competence for jobs, you always look at past performance and make a judgment of that. I understand that Billy has acted as a governor in the past on other boards and has done a good job and has therefore been reappointed. So, I'm not going to justify or try to explain or draw parallels with what political leaders are saying. I will speak for myself. If I did not have confidence in the PUP and its intentions, its bona fides to try to take loyalism in a positive direction, do you think I'd be spending a Saturday morning here? Absolutely not. The reason that I'm here is because I want to work with you to help build a more safe, peaceful and confident society. And, the commentary around other things in the press and Billy's appointment to boards and so on, my experience of Billy Hutchinson is he's well capable of speaking for himself on those issues. But clearly, I think my presence here today is indicative of the support that I want to be and the relationship and trust that I want to build with loyalism and policing.
And, questions for other members of the panel are quite welcome as well.
Absolutely.
Yes, go ahead. Yes, Ken. Yeah.
This morning we spoke about unemployment, we spoke about mental health problems, and what I want to ask the panel and talk about justice recently, and you also mentioned, that loyalism doesn't put its point of view across, mightn't be strong enough. I can assure you, as a loyalist, I'm very confident to put my point of view across. It's the media that doesn't want to listen to us because the good news stories don't want to be heard. Recently, there was a prisoner in McGarvey Prison who suffered from cancer. He spent 34 years in McGarvey Prison, 9 years over which he should ever spend. He was diagnosed 6 times, and on the 6 occasions, he was red flagged. Any woman knows that means that's for cancer. He was missed 6 times. The report that came out from the prison ombudsman was one of the most dominant reports on any prison within the UK. It got about 4 lines in 2 local papers. I got in touch with BBC, UTV, you name it. Nobody wanted to know. Was this because he was a prisoner? Yes. He was a human being and was entitled to the same rights as everyone else. So, whenever you go back to your group and you say that there's no unionist on, tell them that story of a loyalist prisoner who was put down because
I'll answer
you. Yeah.
Was that
yeah.
Makes a prisoner. But he was, as I said again, he was a human being, shown and feet. No more than anyone else, but no less.
Yeah. I take your point. I've worked in various groups of loyalists myself, and some people in the room know this, on media skills training to help them to make their case. And I do think, Ken, you're overlooking a reality that there is a weakness there within the loyalist community and within the grassroots of the party. George has to go very soon, so we need to wrap this up very, very quickly. Fair and enough. Billy has got a speech to make, and there's a chap over here who's been trying to get in. So as quickly as you can.
Yeah,
just to make a quick observation before I pose a question.
Well, it's you're 5 minutes and we're all over.
Is it possible to say about how much he works in statistics and how they steer maybe where the PSNI needs to go? And what you said, Chief Constable, was that out of 69 cases as opposed to 35 loyalists, you inferred that there was a higher proportion being addressed by ATP. But like any statistics, you can turn them to do what you want. So, for example, the statistics you quote equate that 3.8% of Republican investigations but 4.3% of loyalists. So, in actual fact, there was more percentage of the killings that was investigated from loyalists.
Yeah, but he also made the point that he wasn't going to go for a balance of 50-50 anyway. So
the question I wanted to ask, or really for the Chief Constable, but the all the panel was that following the patent reforms, the process known as DDR, disarmament, demobilisation and reintegration, was afforded almost $300 million of taxpayers' funds to, seemingly, the DDR process within the state. So, namely, the change from RUC to PSNI, the dismantling of installations, the doing away of UDR, and so on and so forth. How does the panel feel about a similar process being applied to former non-state actors, given that they simply, literally, geographically can't just go away?
Epic. Is Epic interested in the idea of a demobilisation system for loyalist paramilitaries?
Yeah, very much so. We've been talking about it for years. And while I wouldn't excuse any of the nefarious activity that exists among former paramilitary groupings, I have to say that if people aren't given the opportunity to pursue legitimate livelihoods and there's a raft of barriers in other areas, it's going to make demobilisation of paramilitary groups that much more difficult.
Do you want a quick word on that before we wrap up?
Yeah.
How do you feel about the idea of paramilitary organisations just disbanding and going out of business altogether? Would that not somewhat complicate your work?
No, that'd be great. Okay. That's where we need to get to.
Yeah.
If you were brought into this, into Northern Ireland from outside and heard that there'd been a peace accord signed in 1998 and 17 years later a paramilitary group still existed, it would not be an invalid question to say why are they still there. I mean, at one level you have to ask why they exist, but those of us that are from here and live here understand that actually the reality is that they do still exist, and the challenge now is working for their removal. But it's not just, you know, it would be naive of any of us to say that needs to come with a plan, and this notion of demobilisation or transformation or whatever, because there are so many things. I mean, I've said it, you know, and got myself in trouble around the commentary on the existence of the IRA and commenting on actually some of the functions of that organisation are actually for a positive direction to keep the organisation going in a peaceful way. In the same could be said of various loyalist paramilitary groups, but actually there needs to be a better way of doing that, that we're not based on some sort of military or paramilitary infrastructure, but it's actually about community building, about community cohesion, about integration. And this goes way beyond just the criminal justice and policing issues into the social economic issues. The whole police dividend coming out of the Good Friday Agreement, you know, in some loyalist communities that I have been in and people that I have been talking to without cameras present, they're not feeling the peace dividend. It hasn't actually materialised for them because of jobs and opportunities and education, and there still are social inequalities around deprivation that exist. Not just inequalities between orange and green or loyalist and Republican. I'm talking about where you happen to be born may well influence what opportunities you get in life. So I think that there are much bigger issues here at play. I think paramilitary structures, individuals within it, are trying to use whatever influence that they have, very often for good, but actually we just need a whole paradigm shift so that those paramilitary groups transform, in my view, off the stage completely, go away, and actually those energies and those people that are working for good and for the benefit of society actually channel that in a more legitimate way rather than dressed up in what is actually, for me as a cop, still an illegal organisation. I can't pretend that these organisations are not still proscribed and therefore membership of them is an offence.
So the UVF isn't a butterfly yet? No, I thank you all. I know there's hands up and you want to talk, but we're running really way over time, and the party leader's speech is 45 minutes late, is by my calculation. So what I want you to do now is I want you to thank our guests, Jude White, who gave us a very powerful testimony. George Hamilton, the Chief Constable of the PSNI. And Tom Roberts, Director of EPIC. And if you want to give me a round of applause. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Oh, sorry, one second. Yeah. Do you want this?
No, it's okay. I'll just use the voice. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and delegates, I think you'll all agree with me this morning that we've heard a very enlightening, a very robust and very challenging set of conversations today. I absolutely am definitely a better person for hearing a diverse range of views and a set of opposing views that from which I hold, but I think it is part and parcel to this whole discussion that we don't have to agree with everything that each other holds, but we certainly have to understand where the other person is coming from. And I certainly think today that light rather than heat has been shone on this debate, and I wish to thank each of the contributors for a very honest and informative and instructive perspective on these matters. At times it hasn't been easy, and the questions and the answers have been quite uncomfortable, but that's part and parcel to this debate. And I also wish to thank Malachy for chairing what has been in some parts a bit of a chaotic set of questions that were put forward, but nonetheless I think you've done a sterling job, and I wish to thank you on behalf of the conference and the delegate here today. Thank you.
Thank you.